Welcome, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. Along with Jim Callis, I'm John Manuel. We are brought to you by MLB Network here. Baseball America, we want to remind you that we are the must-read for baseball fans from high school to the big leagues. And now you can try 4 issues of Baseball America for just $4. You visit baseballamerica.com/MLB Network for this special MLB Network offer. And, Jim, it's a good time of year to watch MLB Network because they've got all the post-game wrap-ups from all the playoff games, and the postseason obviously is in full swing. We're going to talk a lot more about draft report cards, but I do feel it'd be kind of remiss to do a podcast in October and not talk about playoff baseball. As we record this, both the championship series are at 3-2, with really the underdogs leading both those championship series, which is somewhat compelling. I don't know if there's a big storyline that jumps out about either of these series, though, Jim, except for the fact that you have the underdogs. You know, I think people expected a Yankees-Phillies World Series, and right now we're staring at a Giants-Rangers World Series. Has there been one big storyline that's jumped out for you from those two series?
I think it's just been fun to watch the pitching, and I think the other thing is, and I think maybe people are catching on, is, you know, I do think the Yankees and Phillies, you know, were the deserving favorites in both series, but I think the Rangers and Giants were better than, I guess, a lot of people gave them credit for. The Rangers can score runs. You know, their lineup, you know, it doesn't cost $200 million. You know, their payroll isn't $200 million like the Yankees, but they have a very formidable lineup. And I actually think the Rangers' starting rotation might be just as good as the Yankees for all the money the Yankees have spent. And, yeah, and similarly, in the National League, I do think the Phillies' lineup is superior to the Giants and markedly superior. But everybody's talking about H2O and the Phillies' pitching. I think the Giants' pitching is just as good. I think the rotation's a little deeper, and their bullpen might be deeper. And the thing I find curious, if the Phillies lose this series, John, and it'll go back to last year with the World Series against the Yankees, why won't Charlie Manuel pitch Brad Lidge in a tie game?
I don't know.
Oswalt loses a game where Brad Lidge could have come in and pitched. And last year, you know, they lost the game. I think it was the game where Damon stole second and just continued on to third base, where, again, he wouldn't pitch Brad Lidge in a tie game in the ninth. And I don't quite understand that.
Yeah, I thought, especially if you're now, their bullpen got short. They'd use a lot of guys. Joe Blanton didn't make it through 5 innings. I really thought that in that case you would use Lidge in the tie game in the ninth. And then if you get to extras, I know it's just throw day, but if anyone's more prepared to go more than an inning, it would be, you know, someone like Roy Oswalt, not Brad Lidge. So I thought you'd see Lidge in the ninth. I definitely was thinking in my head as that game was going on, and they showed that graphic on Fox about how short the Phillies bullpen was getting. I thought, okay, you're going to see Lidge in the ninth, maybe the tenth. But if you go longer than that, I was expecting to see Oswalt. But Oswalt in the ninth is definitely a surprise.
I mean, you can hammer these moves to death, but I just found it curious. I thought it was curious not to use him in a crucial tie game last year. And,
right.
You know, Oswalt, you know, and I'm with you too. I mean, you know, you don't want to leave it to where Lidge is your last guy in the bullpen and he has to go 6 innings or something.
Right,
so,
right. I thought that was
curious. Like in the All-Star game a couple of years ago, but I just thought that was kind of curious because I really thought the timing against the Yankees. You know, if you have faith in Brad Lidge and he's your closer, why are you not bringing him in? And then I thought the same thing the other night. But it's been fun to watch. And, you know, I do suspect, you know, we're recording this on Friday morning, I kind of expect the Yankees to beat Colby Lewis today and then set up a game 7. And I do think the Giants are going to beat the Phillies. I think the Yankees may pull this off.
Really? I have actually more faith in the Phillies coming back than I do in the Yankees. I just think Texas has, you know, I think their athleticism, it's not as they're not as athletic as Tampa, but they had a little bit more power in their lineup. I just don't think Tampa played as well as it could in that series. And I thought Texas just outplayed Tampa. But I think Texas' athleticism bothers the Yankees a little bit, and I just don't think the Yankees will pull it off without Mark Teixeira. I know he didn't have a great year by his standards. It's really been his second worst year as a big leaguer. But I don't think the Yankees, they're not as imposing without Teixeira in the middle of their lineup. I know Lance Berkman's the best reserve a $200 million payroll can buy. That's nice to have a veteran switch hitter on your bench like Lance Berkman, who's shown some thump in the postseason. But I think Texas' athleticism and Cliff Lee's going to help them do that, whereas I think, you know, I could see Roy Oswalt and Cole Hamels just shutting down the Giants lineup, which has scored more than 4 runs once since, what, September 24th, whatever that stat is. It's a decent amount of games, and I like Philly's chances of coming back better than New York's, but But they,
I just hope we get three or four good games. I mean, and I think we will. I think we still have some more excitement coming. So.
Yeah, no, I agree. I also want to pass along that Ken Rosenthal tweeting about, I don't know if you saw where he interviewing Roy Halladay and Jason Wirth at the end of game five. And Kenny is vertically challenged, I guess is the kind way to put it. But he tweeted, for those who want to know, for those who want to know if I'm taller than Pedroia or Kirkjian, no on both, I think. No on the entire planet, basically. So I enjoy
Kenny. I was going to throw Kirkjian out there, and I don't know. I think he might be selling himself a little bit short there, no pun intended. He might be as tall as Tim.
I think that pun was fully intended, but I really do I think that Rosenthal has brought a lot to Fox's broadcast, and I've actually enjoyed the TV broadcast in the postseason too. So it's been a good for me. It's been a good month for baseball wise, and I've enjoyed the postseason more than I thought I would. Maybe it helps to not have emotions wrapped up in it and just get to watch what I think has been quality baseball. And like you said, enjoying the pitching. But a lot of these teams, and one of the things that really stands out when you watch the Giants, Jim. It's just how homegrown – their best players are homegrown guys, with the exception of Aubrey Huff. But that team really is in the postseason. The number one reasons are their homegrown pitchers and Buster Posey. And, you know, I had to find a team. I would like to do some research. It might be for my column for this issue about what teams have had better hits 3 years in a row in the first round than Tim Lincecum, Madison Bumgarner, and Buster Posey. Obviously, Bumgarner is not at the level yet of a Lincecum or a Posey. But he has been a very effective fourth starter for them this year. And that is a nice segue for me into our draft report cards. And I think, one of the things we do in draft report cards, Jim, is rate the drafts. Here are the top five drafts. And this year was pretty fascinating to do that exercise because you're trying to figure out the best drafts. And, you know, the depth versus star power argument comes up again. You and I have discussed this a lot. But I think I'd rather have a draft where you get Tim Lincecum and nothing else than have a draft where you get four or five decent big leaguers. I mean, that's an extreme case, but I think we're seeing with the Giants, star power is what gets you to the playoffs.
Oh, I agree, and I've said that for years, too. I mean, you obviously want to try to hit on as many draft picks, and you'd like to have as deep a farm system as possible. When it comes down to it, I think you win with stars. You know, if you have, you know, a Lincecum and a Buster Posey and two or three other, you know, Matt Keane, you know, two or three other guys who are well above average players, you can surround those guys with pretty average, pretty reasonably cost talent and win. I don't think there's any question about that. You know, and I agree with you. And I think, too, you know, if you look at it, if you go back and you look at a typical draft, I don't think fans necessarily realize how little, you know, above average talent, major league talent there is in a draft. You might, in a typical draft, have about, a half dozen guys you would, you know, classify as, you know, certified flat-out stars. Then you might have another 12 or 18 guys in a typical draft who are, you know, solid, above average, big league players for a number of years. And then you're talking about maybe another two dozen guys who are, you know, solid contributors, but they're really complementary players, you know, more, you know, maybe your seventh inning reliever or a good utility guy or a decent, you know, platoon player. And that's it. You know, you're talking in a typical draft, you're getting 50 players who are truly useful, and then you're getting a bunch of other guys who either, you know, range from, you know, one or two at-bats or innings in the big leagues to, you know, maybe, you know, they're a below-average regular on a mediocre team or, a, you know, just an end-of-the-bench type of guy. You know, so in a typical draft, if you get two good major league players, you're doing better than the average.
Right.
You know, and if you're getting one of the half-dozen superstars in the draft, you know, then you're doing great. And then the funny thing is really outside of the first, you know, say four or five picks in a draft, which there's usually a consensus, and this year there was a consensus top three, you know, those other, you know, half dozen superstars in the draft, you know, I mean, there may be one or two in the first five picks, those other four or five superstars could fall anywhere in the draft. You know, sometimes it's the first round, sometimes it's the 62nd round with Mike Piazza. So,
right.
You know, just because your team isn't picking high doesn't mean that, you know, there are good players in the draft for a long time out there. You just have to identify them.
Right, right. And that's obviously the biggest challenge. Well, let's talk about the teams that we ranked at the top of the draft. We went Indians, Red Sox, Blue Jays, Rockies, Nationals. Obviously, a huge part of this is not just drafting the players, but signing the players. And I don't think it hurts that the Indians really invested in their draft $9.4 million in their first 10 rounds, correct?
That's the whole draft.
The whole draft. Yeah, I shouldn't say first 10 rounds because obviously they went over slot a little bit too. But I think we both agree the Indians draft was the best draft. You know, obviously starting off with Drew Pomeranz, mixing in a little LeVon Washington, who was a first rounder in 2009. A guy who's definitely a mixed bag, not a universally appreciated guy by scouts, I'll say, but a guy with some athleticism, speed. And if you like him, you really believe in the bat. Robbie Aviles, a guy who is a nice risk, I think, to take it set in the seventh round. A guy like Tommy John near the end of his high school season, but it could have gone in the first three rounds if he'd been healthy. What else really stood out for you about this Indians draft class as far as making it the number one class?
Well, I think when we're looking at the top classes too, like you said, John, I mean, it's, you know, at this point, you know, we haven't seen a lot of these guys on the field, especially with the signing deadline. So many guys go to the deadline, you don't get a whole lot to judge them on. And even if they do play pro ball, their first summer, they're usually playing at a low level, so it's not like you can judge a lot. So I think the drafts that jump out to both of us are the ones where it seems like the team got a disproportionate share of talent. And then there's two ways of doing that. One, you can have a lot of extra picks because you lost free agents like the Blue Jays did, and we'll talk about them in a minute. Or you can invest heavily like the Indians did. You know, a couple other guys they got who I think are really interesting. You know, Tony Walters got first-round money in the third round. Yeah, and, you know, you'll hear a little bit, you know, like with almost anybody in the draft, there's a little bit of differing opinion. You know, is he a shortstop? Is he not a shortstop? But, you know, I think you're looking at possibly a very offensive, you know, guy who gets his job done at shortstop, or a good offensive second baseman. Kyle Blair in the fourth round, you know, could have been, you know, maybe a first-round pick out of high school if he were signable. I think that's a tremendous value there.
Absolutely.
Alex Levisky, I really like in the eighth round. He got $1 million. I mean, that's late first-round money. He's a catcher with good power, good arm strength. And, I mean, I joked, he's in the, you know, I do Ohio for our draft coverage. And, you know, I was joking with area scouts. I mean, he's the one guy, in the one catcher in the draft, high school catcher. You know, you don't have to worry, like, okay, what's going to happen when he has to face you know, has to receive quality pitching.
Right.
You know, we were joking, that's one guy who probably think pro ball is easier than high school because he caught Stetson Alley, who probably had as electric stuff as anybody but didn't always know where it was going. So, yeah, I like him. And even, you know, you keep going on down in that draft. You know, you got even Jordan Cooper in the ninth round. He's a really good – he really knows how to pitch. Tyler Holt in the 10th round out of Florida State. It doesn't necessarily do things, you know, in the prettiest fashion according to scouts, but, you know, in terms of playing defense and getting on base and running on base, you know, once he gets there, he was one of the better guys in college, and I think they got one of the better steals in the draft in the 23rd round. Tony Dischler, junior college pitcher, was 91-94 all spring. He led LSU Unis to the Division II JUCO national title. And we thought, I mean, he was a guy who could have gone, you know, third to fifth, fourth to seventh round. And when he dropped that low, I assumed, you know, like we usually do, okay, that guy must be asking for a lot of money. He's going to want to go into college. And they signed him for $255,000, which, you know, isn't, you know, out of line at all. I mean, that's what he would have gotten in about the fifth round anyway.
Absolutely. Now, I definitely love I'm a Tyler Holt guy. I believe in Tyler Holt. I think he's going to hit. I think he's going to run. I think he's going to be better than people think. That's his entire motivation, is to be better than people think he would be. They actually have, I don't think he probably came up at all in your draft report card, but one of Dave Perkins' favorite players the last few years has been Kyle Petter, their 34th round pick, a left-hander at El Camino JC, coached by former Indians farmhand Nate Fernley, who led El Camino JC to the Final Four of California JUCOs. And Kyle Petter is just a little left-hander, spins a breaking ball, has some arm strength. Wouldn't shock me if Kyle Petter wound up as a big league reliever in the 34th round, just making this class, for me, a little bit deeper. I think it's always nice to have a guy like that toward the bottom of your draft who's also got a shot too. But I think, you know, obviously, like we said, these drafts are built at the top. And the Red Sox, Jim, I believe, have ranked in our top five in drafts the last 4 or 5 years. It's probably true.
And again, I mean, I think that comes down to the fact that I think there's no question, year in, year out, they're the most aggressive team in the draft in terms of being willing to give, you know, first round, sandwich round money to players, even if they don't take them that high. And they did it again this year. I mean, they wound up given, you know, if you sandwich round money to or better to their top six picks in the draft. And then they gave, you know, second round money to their sixth rounder and their 11th rounder, you know, and then they even paid a little bit for some other guys too. So they're not afraid of investing in the draft. And, you know, they have a bunch of guys who they didn't sign. It might be pretty good picks 3 years from now too. They kind of look at it as the high-end investment. You know, we're going to take, you know, in a lot of cases, the best guy on the board just about every round, and we'll sign as many of them as we can.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's and I don't think, I mean, like, to me, their top guy, their top pick, Colburn Vidic, is not their top player they drafted. Clearly, that, I would think that's Anthony Renato. He's got the highest ceiling. Who's next in your mind, though, on in terms of ceiling for that Red Sox draft class? I have a hard time picking who I think is their second highest ceiling. Would it be, is it Garen Cecchini? Is it Colburn Vidic, their first pick? Yeah, to me, Vidic looks like has a chance to be a really solid player. I don't think he has star potential, though. Who would you say is the next in terms of star potential after Anthony Renato?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why we like the draft so much. You know, I like Garen Cecchini a lot. If my gut would say pick Garen Cecchini. You know, and I'm working on our Red Sox top 30 prospect list, and Garen Cecchini won't be their second guy out of their draft on their list, but my gut is that he might be that guy. I think he was pretty much as good as any high school hitter in the draft. He just tore up an ACL early in the season,
yep.
Didn't play much, and he wanted a bunch of money. He wanted $1.75 million, which is why he lasted until the fourth round. But I think he's going to be kind of a prototypical third baseman. You know, Vidic probably has more all-around tools. I mean, Vidic's got, you know, depending on how much you like him, I mean, you could project Vidic as an above-average hitter with at least average power, although in pre-draft workouts for a few teams, I mean, he was putting balls in the second deck in San Diego, for instance. So if you dream, you can maybe say he's got plus power. And, you know, once he gets going, he's a plus runner underway. And, I mean, he's a guy who threw 90, up to 92 off the mound, so he's got a good arm too. I like Cecchini a little bit more. The Red Sox played Vidic at third base. I know when I was doing our draft stuff, Indiana's another one of my states, you know, that I covered before the draft. I just don't think he has those true infield actions, and I don't think he has the hands, the soft hands to really play the infield. So then he's probably an outfielder. And while some teams thought, you know, okay, this guy's a chance to play center field, you know, I don't know in the Red Sox system if he's going to get a chance to play center field as much as it would be a corner. Just when you look at a guy like Jeremy Hazelbaker, their fifth-round pick from last year, who's a plus-plus runner. But, you know, he didn't play center field this year because he's on a team with Ray Fuentes. They have guys who fit the center field profile more. So I guess it's a long way of saying, John, I think Cecchini probably has a better chance to be a star because when you factor in positional value, I think Vidic's going to wind up as a right fielder.
Right.
And I think Cicchini's going to stay at third base. And I wouldn't rule out, I mean, two other guys you could throw in there, Sean Coyle, who, you know, he's going to be a second baseman, but he can really, really hit, and he's got some pop, and he can run. And Bryce Brents, you know, is a guy who, you know, is a fairly good athlete with a lot of power potential. So, you know, they kind of spread the wealth out there.
Yeah, and that's why that's why we like their drafts. I mean, they spread the wealth, and they just don't have all their draft is not tied up in whether or not Anthony Renato, you know, makes it or not. And conversely, they didn't make our top five, but the Pittsburgh Pirates, to me, Jim, are like one of the most interesting drafts this year. They wound up not making our top five when basically they got the two best arms, just pure arms, in the draft, and Jameson Taillon, who was the best pitcher available this year, and Stetson Alley, who we already talked about, just in terms of pure stuff. Throws in the has flashed upper 90s velocity and has flashed, you know, like a 90 mile an hour power slider, like a John Smoltz, you know, two pitch mix, really, basically, at a Stetson Alley. Yet the Pirates didn't make our top five. Obviously, you have to draw the line somewhere. I think we both thought they were a top 10 draft.
Sure.
But, you know, what did you think? I don't know if we've talked about this, but what did you think about the fact that you have to go to the 11th round before you find, they basically drafted one, in the first 10 rounds, they drafted one player who was not a right-handed pitcher. That struck me as strange. And I didn't get a chance to discuss that really with the Pirates, you know, in discussing their draft report card with them. But that just, that struck me as odd. And almost, that's almost what was a barrier for me for picking them in the top five, even though they got potentially two stars in Taillon and Alley.
I agree with you, John. I think they are top 10 draft. You know, we draw the cutoff at five. I think if we were ranking best, you know, two picks for any team, They might be number one.
Right.
I think I would take those two guys over, say, Bryce Harper and A.J. Cole, for instance. So, I mean, they would be number one. But it's, you know, I didn't think their depth necessarily put them in the top ten. It was very right-handed heavy. You know, maybe they literally took the take the best player available on our board to an extreme. I don't think their system is that loaded with hitters that they consciously said, oh, let's just load up on pitching. I did think that was curious. And, you know, I mean, for me, the reason they weren't a top five draft is, you know, their third round pick, you know, maybe it's a guy I'm just overly familiar with, but, you know, Mel Rojas Jr. was kind of a hot button player.
Yeah.
Up here in Illinois, where there were a couple guys who loved, if you saw him on his best day, they loved him. But he was, he's one of the guys I'm really interested to see what happens to him in pro ball, because if you talk to guys who liked him, they're like, okay, you know, major league bloodlines, his dad was a big league closer, he's 6'3", 200, switch hitter, good bat speed, he's strong, and he led the national junior college players in steals. And then you talk to other guys, and they're saying, well, you know what, his pure speed is just, you know, slightly above average, he's stealing those bases on JUCO catchers, his swing's real flat, so he hits a lot of ground balls, and he really doesn't barrel the ball consistently, and he might not be quick enough for center. So, I mean, obviously the Pirates liked him on the high end. But, I mean, he's one of the few guys, you know, again, the JUCO players are harder to scout, that, you know, you get, you know, some guys will tell you he's a five-tool center fielder, and our guys will tell you, I really don't see a tool that plays his plus. So, he's a real interesting one, and as you alluded to, he's the only position player they sign out the first 10 rounds of the draft.
Yeah, and the guys they drafted further on down, other position players, are guys like Dan Grovot, and I'm sure I'm not pronouncing his name right, but Drew Maggi they gave a lot of money to. I like Drew Maggi. I'm not there on that guy or Jared Lakend being your second hitter. There's not a lot of diversity to their system, to their draft. That said, we could look back on this 5 years from now with Stetson Alley and maybe Stetson Alley's their closer and Jameson Taillon's their number one starter, and those are the two reasons why the Pirates have stopped their string of losing seasons at 20 or something like that. You know, I mean.
Oh, you're right. Well, that goes back to what I was saying. You know, I mean. You know, and again, I fault him a little bit for not signing four picks in the first 10 rounds. I like gambling on guys, but, you know, Austin Kubica had a $2 million price tag. If you wanted to make a run to him, you could have taken him in the 20th round.
Right, take a position player, take a hitter.
You know, get a guy you can sign. And they did spend in round, you know, after the 10th round, too, so it kind of evened out. But, you know, what we were saying before, I mean, you know, right now, I mean, to me, that's somewhere in the 6 to 10 range. But it's very possible that of the six, you know, say, superstars in this draft, the Pirates might get two of them, and if that's the case, then it's the best draft.
Right.
And that's kind of, you know, it's, you know, we don't put letter grades on every draft like we used to, and I think that might even been before you started working for Baseball America, John. But when I started working for them, I would put letter grades on them every year.
Yeah, no, I remember that was the first. I think it was the last draft report because you did them with. I think I was still getting photos for those guys. Remember my Matt?
Okay, well there you go.
Matt Halloran sent me his prom picture and wrote on the back. Keep this autograph; it'll be worth something someday. And I don't think Matt Halloran made it out of Class A. So
poor Matt Halloran. But you know, it's like the scouting directors always hated having letter grades on there, and they're just saying, you know, even less so. You know, everybody, even the NFL teams, you know, will complain. Oh, you know, we're getting graded on our draft right after the draft, and you don't know. Well, these guys, in most cases, are 3 or 4 years from the majors, and you just don't know. I mean, really, all you can judge these guys on are, you know, how are these players evaluated before the draft. And then in a few rare cases, okay, this guy, you know, went into pro ball and he was better than we thought. But, you know, I think I guess the way I always look at this, John, is it's guesswork. I mean, I think it's in our cases, very educated guesswork.
Right.
We put a lot of time into it. But you just don't know. I mean, you know, we're sitting here talking about the Pirates and, you know, the Moneyball acolytes will sit there and tell, you know, high school pitching's so risky. And I don't think it's that much more risky than college pitching. But, again, I mean, a lot can happen to a pitcher's. You know, I mean, we're talking about the Pittsburgh Pirates, I mean, who've been the franchise that's had more first-round picks go down, you know, to pitching injuries than probably any in the last 10 or 15 years. It's not out of the realm of possibility that Taillon and Alley could get hurt, and then they get nothing, too. So you just don't know how it turns out with these guys.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the Baseball America podcast with John Manuel and Jim Callis. Thanks for joining us. We're brought to you by the MLB Network. Jim, one of the things I want to also touch on here is I think one of our favorite categories is the most intriguing background. And we always seem like we usually disagree about what intrigues us. It's the most open-ended category of draft report cards. But I think we actually we seem to agree more this year than usual. You know, you usually have your mix of your baseball relatives and your non-baseball relatives. I liked our baseball relatives this year were pretty cool. I mean, the biggest name at five, Delino DeShields, I think was the most obvious name just because he's a junior. But Cam Bedrosian, I love the fact that his middle name, I believe, is Rock. Cameron Rock.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's Cameron Rock Bedrosian.
I did not know that.
Yeah, obviously for his dad being nicknamed Bedrock in his big league career. Avni Guillen, who almost caused the unraveling of the White Sox front office. I just think it was awesome that we listed Avni Guillen. He gets extra points for the contentiousness there. And the backstory.
I think we decided what, John, that there were four or five teams that drafted the sons of their current big league manager.
Right.
But we decided that because Kenny Williams and Ozzie Guillen almost came to blows over how low Ozzie went in the draft compared to where Kenny Williams Jr. had gone in the draft a few years ago,
that
was the tiebreaker, and he was the most intriguing of all those guys.
I'm not sure Ozzie Guillen is 16 rounds worse than Kenny Williams Jr.
Oh, I'm trying to put this in a kind way. I don't think
you can
many
pass.
Teams outside of Chicago evaluated Kenny Williams Jr. as anywhere close to a sixth-round pick.
Yes, but then we have
I don't think where they went in the draft is any reflection. I dare say that Ozzie Guillen is probably a better prospect than Kenny Williams Jr.
I'm with you on that. And then Joe Jackson of the Royals and Kendall Radcliffe to the Rangers. Explain why those guys were the most intriguing backgrounds.
Well, Kendall Radcliffe is the great nephew of Double Duty Radcliffe, who I keep thinking is in the Hall of Fame, and he's not, but he's pretty much as good as any two-way player in Negro League history. And then Joe Jackson, I think, is another great, I want to say nephew, but it might be grandson, of Shoeless Joe Jackson. So you don't too often get a Shoeless Joe Jackson reference in the draft report cards, but we had to go with that one.
I also love that the White Sox still have the Double Duty Classic, named for Double Duty Radcliffe. It's a tribute game for high school players, basically, in Chicago every year. And it's also like an event that kind of celebrates the history of Negro League baseball. And I love that. I love that they're still the White Sox have kept alive the Double Duty Radcliffe, that name and his role in the Negro Leagues. And I'm disappointed the White Sox did not draft Kendall Radcliffe.
Well, I think what might have happened there, and I didn't talk to them specifically about this, and by the way, Joe Jackson is the great-great-nephew of Shoeless Joe.
Okay.
Kendall Radcliffe was a guy whose name came up. I mean, he's a Chicago high school kid who's athletic, but is extremely, extremely raw. I mean, you hear people talk about the term two-year rookie ball guy, like a player you draft that's going to need 2 years of rookie ball before he's ready.
Yep.
Well, I talked to area scouts who were kind of intrigued by Radcliffe's athleticism, but said, you know, that guy might be a three-year rookie guy. And there were scouts I talked to who liked him, but said, you know what, that guy really needs to go to junior college or college and play. While I like him, I don't want to draft him because I don't think he's ready for pro ball. So
right.
It could have been a case where the White Sox, you know, said, you know what, this kid's better off going to college and signing us, you know, having signed him right now and then throwing him right into pro ball. But so that might have been it. I'm sure they knew who he was because he's right there in their backyard and their connection to Double Duty.
And then I think we also liked in the not baseball relatives that Matt Caesar of the Cubs via Villanova was the most intriguing background there. I mean, this is a guy who's a legitimate NFL prospect, is kind of a Bryant Westbrook type of back, correct? Is that a fair? You're more of a football guy.
He's more of a slot receiver, return guy,
okay,
type of guy. But the coach there,
Wes Welker,
said he's faster than Bryant Westbrook was when Westbrook was there.
He's like a Wes Welker type then, is what you're saying, because he's a smallish wide receiver, right?
Yeah, but a lot faster. And I was looking recently, I finally saw, you know, Pro Football Weekly actually did a little note in their last issue on baseball prospects in this year's football draft, and they have him paid as like a fourth or fifth round NFL pick right now.
Interesting. And then, of course, he also has where he's donating a kidney, I believe.
No, it was bone marrow. The Villanova coach has all his players, I don't know if it's a blood test, but basically all his players submit to a test and join the national bone marrow registry.
Ah.
It, you know, it's very hard sometimes to find a match. And
yeah.
There was a 1-year-old girl who had some form of, I want to say leukemia, who needed a bone marrow transplant, and last fall, Caesar came up as a match. And actually, you know, when you're doing these transplants, you have to be ready to go kind of at any time. And he was willing to miss the it's not Division I AA, but I guess it's what, the Football Championship Series.
FCS.
yeah, playoffs for Villanova, he was going to wind up missing either the semifinal or championship game to go through. And it's a tough thing. It's not just like you're donating blood. I mean, it's you lose a lot of strength. It takes a lot. You know, donating bone marrow is not, you know, something that you bounce back from very quickly. And he was ready to give up playing championship game, you know, told the coach, hey, you know, this is more important than us playing. Well, she, I want to say the little girl came down with a cold or something, so it wasn't optimal. He wound up playing in the playoffs. Villanova won the national championship. He was MVP of the national championship game. Went for, I think, something like 280 or 300 all-purpose yards in the game. You had tremendous games. Then in the spring, you know, he's a draft prospect. But again, you know, it comes up, you know, she still needs the donation. And then there was a time to give, you know, that would have worked out right in the middle of baseball season. And, you know, and I guess some guys could have said, hey, you know what, I can't do, you know, I need to be my best for baseball. No, I mean, he donated, and I think he missed 3 weeks of action. And I was talking to Tim Wilkin, their scouting director, and hit a home run in his first at-bat, I believe, when he came back, and went 10 for 15, you know, with the Cubs bearing down on him. And, I mean, between the NFL potential and just the story with the little girl, which is, you know, I think it's one of the things everybody likes to say, would like to think, hey, you know, I'd do the same thing if I were in a situation, but, you know, I'm not sure everybody would have. And right. Between that and, I mean, the guy's a tremendous athlete, and he came out and hit close to 400 in a short stint in the Northwest League. He's very, very interesting. And
he's a legit prospect.
I mean, I could have written 500 words on his background, you know, in the 500-word draft report card. But you know, he also has kind of a unique deal with the Cubs where, you know, his contract is set up. It's a two-tiered contract where he got an initial bonus to come out and play pro ball, you know, as a fifth-round pick. But, you know, they don't know what's going to happen with him with the NFL draft. Well, if he – I forget the date of the combine. It's sometime in February, the NFL combine. If he gives them a written, you know, written letter, you know, this signature, it says he's giving up football, will not attend the combine, he will earn an extra $500,000 bonus on top of the $100,000 he already signed for. So that's his story is very, very interesting. I don't know how I'm going to, you know, cram that into 250 words in the prospect handbook, but I'll try somehow.
Well, he might have to get the Andrew Brackman exception. Cause I think
the Charlton Jimerson treatment. So.
That's right. Some guys
to Caesar.
Some guys write up to get a little bit more space in the prospect handbook, and we try to enforce those 250 words limits for J.J. Cooper, or else that the Reds and Royals fans would get a lot more than anybody else would get. It's the Baseball America podcast with John and Jim. Jim, the other thing I wanted to point out, one or two other things I wanted to point out with draft report cards. We do have an email, though, on our Facebook page. It's Baseball America. It's a Facebook / Baseball America page on for our official Facebook page. Stephen Tarpley asks, how much has Jacob Thompson of the Rays and Corey Vaughn of the Mets, how much have they improved their status since the draft? How much do rookie and low A-ball numbers really mean for four-year college players? And those are two guys who took the New York Penn League kind of by storm. They were both outstanding. Jake Thompson, of course, a guy who was at Long Beach State, really kind of had three middling seasons there. After,
but he was young, right? Didn't he come out of high school as a junior?
Yeah, that's
the
interesting thing.
He went to college a year early, too.
He did, but, you know, he's actually not young. He would have been old. He would have been Jeremy Bonderman old if he'd stayed for all his high school career. So he's 21. He turned 21 in August. So he was 20 when he was drafted, so a little bit on the young side, but not overly so. And then Corey Vaughn, son of Greg Vaughn, the ex of big league slugger who hit 50 home runs in 1 year for the Padres. For me, Jim, really, I'm almost more impressed when a hitter goes out and does it, especially at Brooklyn, where, you know, Ike Davis famously went out and had a terrible debut, didn't even hit a home run, and then a year and a half later was in the big leagues and had a solid rookie season, not a great rookie season, but a solid rookie year with the Mets this year. Whereas Jake Thompson really was outstanding at Hudson Valley and then had, you know, 11 scoreless innings for Charlotte. I actually think I'm a little bit more impressed with Vaughn because he had so much swing and miss in college, and he did not have as many problems with that. I mean, he did still have contact issues a little bit in Brooklyn, but he's got big tools. He can run. He has power. He might be a nice find for the Mets. What was he, like a third-round pick, fourth-round pick?
I think fourth-round pick, yeah.
But overall, though, I don't think their debuts change a whole lot about how they view them. I'm more optimistic about them than I would have been if they had a bad debut, but I don't think it – so far, I still think of them, you know, as good prospects, but not any kind of a Stone Cold Lead Pipe Lock.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, the thing is, you know, the debuts is what I was trying to get out there. The debuts for both those guys are nice, but I don't think they changed the long-term prognosis a whole lot. I mean, both those guys did get drafted a little earlier than we thought they would. And, you know, so far, so good. It's just, you know, I think stats mean a lot more. I keep borrowing this line. Theo Epstein said this about 6 or 7 years ago. The stats mean a lot more as you get higher up the minor league ladder. And, you know, there's plenty of guys who put up big numbers in the lower levels. You know, neither of those guys was in the Pioneer League, which is a hitter's paradise. But, you know, you'll see guys put up huge numbers in the Pioneer League, and then you never hear from them again. And so I think you look at it as a positive first step. You know, I look at both those guys, and, you know, in the back of my mind, I think, okay, you know, maybe those guys were a little bit better than I thought they were. But, you know, I don't think those guys – I'm not looking at their performances, say, and thinking, geez, those guys should have been first-round picks, or they'd be first-round picks if the draft happened again. I actually have a question that came into us via Twitter, John.
Okay.
From J.P. Schwartz of Springfield, Illinois. No stranger to BA Chats or podcasts. And he wants to know who we think is the best draft pick from the 25th round or beyond that we think is the draft's biggest sleeper.
Hmm. 25th round?
I'll throw out two names, and I don't know if you have – any thoughts, but we kind of, when we look at late round picks, I think you almost have to do this. We split them into two categories. You have your over slot guys and your guys who, you know, were not slot picks, because,
right,
you know, if you're willing to pay $500,000 to a guy, you know, in the 26th round or whatever, that's not that's not really a sleeper. That's a guy who fell because of signability. And, you know, but one of the teams I did, and that's why these two guys jump out at me, is the Dodgers when we're doing draft report cards. And they had a guy who fell into each category. They had a 26th-round pick out of Des Moines Area Community College named Scott Schebler, who they signed for $300,000 on the day of the signing deadline.
He sounds interesting.
Yeah, he was. I mean, he was a guy who had a nice year, really hit well at Des Moines Area Community College. But, again, it's Iowa Junior College competition, so it's hard to say – You can't really judge a whole lot based on that. But guys said he could hit, and he's athletic. He was going to go to Wichita State as a sophomore. And then he went to the Northwoods League over the summer and just had a tremendous summer. And, yeah, Northwoods League, John, I think we talked about internally, and Aaron Fitt pushed our top prospect list to 20 players this year. That's probably the second-best summer league right now.
Now, there's no probably about it.
I don't think it gets nearly the amount of credit it deserves. And he went up there and played great. So I think he's the overslot signing. And then in the 30th round – they got Sean Tolleson out of Baylor, and Tolleson was a guy who, coming out of high school, would have probably been a first-round or first-two-round pick if he hadn't gotten hurt.
Right.
And then Baylor, he was just up and down and very inconsistent, and for whatever reason, you know, pro ball, you maybe was just, you know, pitching on a more regular basis, you know, you have games every day. They used him out of the bullpen, and, I mean, shoot, he was 90-94 with a good breaking ball, and it looked like a guy who, you know, might be a very good reliever in a couple of years for their big league team. So those were probably the two guys who jumped out to me from round 25 on down.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the one who I love the Sean Tolleson pick. He did have a really nice debut, and there's something there. There's no doubt there's something there. I kind of like Eric Pettis, the right-hander that the Phillies drafted in the 35th round. He had a ridiculous debut, and I kind of lump him in with the Phillies. Have this very good recent track record of creating value with some college pitchers who get drafted late. They did it with guys like Vance Worley. They didn't draft late, but Mike Stutz was a guy they drafted like in the 9th round, that kind of thing. He's already got the AAA. Mike Sisko was like a 30-something round pick. He's already gotten the AA. Austin Hyatt is a guy who they jumped to high A in 2010. It was like a 15th round pick. They've done very well with him. You know, Pettis was a 35th round pick. And, you know, first I have faith in Gorman Heimuller. Second of all, I have faith that Eric Pettis has a long track record of success in college, where he both was a closer and a starter at UC Irvine. The one question I have about Pettis is that he's been used. He threw a lot in college, and he threw a lot this year. I think he got close to 180 innings between the two in 2010. So that's one guy that, you know, stood out for me because his debut was quite good. And he's not 25th round or down, but you know, the guy who's the upper slot guy for me was Eric Goodell of the Mets in the 24th round, $350,000. Yeah, the Mets are not known for going over slot. It's very rare. They did it twice this year, I guess, with Matt Harvey and then Goodell. But I really like Eric Goodell. He might be the second-best player they drafted. Another guy like Sean Tolleson was a big deal as a high school junior. entering his high school senior year, had Tommy John. Took him a while to get back to his top form, but he was a guy that, you know, our Dave Perkins saw him late in the regular season with UCLA and saw him outstanding. I got that confirmed by the Mets that they saw him that well, you know, pitched that well. John Savage, the UCLA coach in Omaha, the Cal World Series, was like, please stop writing about how good Eric Goodell looks right now because we're probably going to lose him. And they did lose him. And, 24th round pick to me, we had him as the number two above slot bonus. And, that's a pick I'd be very enthusiastic about if I were a Mets fan. So I'm sorry for our reader. I jumped a little bit ahead of the 25th round, but I'm going to cheat a little bit and have Eric Goodell in the 24th round as my other top guy. So that's
fine. I think it's fair.
Kind of where we stand on those. I guess the other obvious one, we've talked about this a little bit, Jim, but ones that got away, I think it was just kind of stark this year, though, and just how the high school pool of players who got away was pretty outstanding, whereas the college group of players, it's not a great group of college seniors that's going back to campus this year. Pretty much, if you were a college junior this year, I don't know if that's attributable to the money being bigger now or the fact that the college class this year wasn't that strong, so it really got picked over pretty hard.
I think it's the leverage. I just don't think you have – you know, this year they spent $195 million, which was an industry record on draft bonuses, and yet, we could have gone 10 or 15 deep on very talented high school players who didn't sign.
Right.
And on the colleges, we had trouble coming with five, and I just think it goes to show. And teams, I think, were a little bit more aware this year, played it a little smarter. You mentioned Matt Harvey got over slot. Well, none of the college pitchers got a ton of money over slot.
Correct.
Pomerantz, Chris Sale, Matt Harvey, Deck McGuire.
Anthony Renato.
Anthony Renato. Well, Renato got a lot over slot because of where he went. But, the guys who went high, usually a couple of those guys get big league contracts. And, we saw last year the Indians did it with Alex White last year and with Drew Pomerantz this year. If you're a college junior, you have some leverage in that you can go back to school. But once you go back to school or you go play independent ball or whatever you wind up doing, then you've really lost a lot of leverage because nobody takes you seriously the second time around that you're really going to go back into the draft for a third year in a row. And I just think, almost all of your top college picks are going to sign because they're going to have a hard time making any more money. I mean, John, look at the guys who didn't sign this year, our top five college picks. Number one, Barrel outs with the Diamondbacks, didn't pass the physical, or he would have signed for $2 million, which would have been a little under slot.
Right.
So it wasn't like he was holding out for big money. He just didn't pass the team's physical. Number two was a junior college player, Austin Wood, who does have a ton of leverage remaining. He's transferring to Southern California. He looked very good in the Cape Cod League. He was part of a championship team in the Cape. But, he was inconsistent in college, and guys don't know what to make of him.
I'm not a believer on Austin. I'll go on record again. I'm not a believer in the arm strength, big body guy who can't even be a high leverage reliever on a junior college team. I mean, I'm just not.
He wasn't your typical college guy either. Your number three guy on our list is Birch Smith from Howard Junior College. He's another junior college guy who, has a chance, if he puts it all together, to go in the top two or three rounds
next year, and
that's why he went to Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Number four on our list was really the only traditional, typical, college junior going back for a senior year was Cole Green out of Texas. Tigers took him in the fourth round. And Cole Green, very high on pitchability. Stuff is probably very average by pro standards. And they just disagreed over what he was worth. And so he went back. And it wasn't like he turned down a ton of money. And then the fifth guy was Josh Osich, who, has been seen in the upper 90s before he had Tommy John surgery. And, the Angels, I give him credit, made a run at him. But, if Osich comes back and he's healthy this year, he could be a first-round pick. So really, the only one of those guys who really gave up all his leverage, and Osich will be a redshirt junior this year. The only guy who gave up all his leverage by going back there was Cole Green.
Right.
Whereas on the high school side, you had any number of guys going to college.
Yeah, and I agree. To me, it's really stood out at the college. It's not a great group of those college seniors. Where in the past, you've had some guys. It's been a while, but I just think of the Kenny Baughs or the Seth Ethertons or some of these guys who, were good college juniors, went back into the draft as seniors and ended up as first round, kind of bargain first round picks.
Yeah, and I think I counted, John. I want to say, looking at our pre-draft top 200 prospect list, there were 13 high school players in our top 100 who wound up going to college, and there was one four-year college player who wound up not signing, and that was Barrett Laux.
And Barrett Laux is where we probably should end this. I mean, he's still out there, still a free agent. We both checked in on the Barrett Lau situation while we were doing draft report cards. I didn't really hear a whole lot of teams that were terribly interested in Barrett Lau. It sounded like the workouts, that the number of teams there had dwindled from 20 to 13 to 10, 8 or 9 or 10. Any rumblings out there that you're hearing about Barrett Lau?
Not specifically. I mean, I know there was some perception, I think, among some fans that the Diamondbacks are pulling the fast one, that, you know, when they fired Josh Burns, who was apparently a big proponent of taking Lau, that, you know, they were going to get a better, you know, get the same pick in next year's draft, which is a better draft. And I don't think they pulled a fast one. There were a number of teams, you know, again, he was one of my draft area guys in Texas, a number of teams that didn't want to take him before the draft. They did not have him cleared medically. He had shoulder problems in high school. He had bone chips removed from his elbow as a sophomore. And that was just a number of teams said, look, you know, we're not going to take him because of that. Also, I mean, just from a scouting standpoint, he's got a very good arm, but he's got one plus pitch. I mean, his fastball is very good. It's got good velocity. It's got good life. He throws it easy, so it looks quicker. But he doesn't really have a plus breaking ball. I mean, if you're guessing, I'm guessing he's more of a reliever than a starter in the long run. And I think, you know, now that, you know, we all know that the Diamondbacks looked at his shoulder and elbow and were concerned about the wear and tear. You know, it's not like he has an injury that prevents him from pitching. It's more how long is this guy going to hold up? So you already had some teams that weren't going to take him medically before the draft without being able to give him any kind of examination. And now I think there's probably more teams concerned. And, you know, hey, I think his workouts, from what I've sensed, have gone okay. You know, velocity's down a little bit. The command's down a little bit. But, you know, the guy hadn't pitched in many months, so I don't think anybody's holding that against him. But, you know, I think essentially he's a sandwich round talent. You know, somewhere around the 40th best player in the draft if he's healthy. And then you throw in health concerns. And I just don't think there's, you know, I'm sure whatever they're looking for monetarily is not in line with what teams think he's worth right now. And I just haven't heard of anybody who's going to jump up and grab him at whatever the price is right now. I mean, the rumors I heard were, you know, price tag around $750,000. And it sounds like nobody's jumping in for that price right now. Yeah, you know, but, you know, again, there's no real hurry. I mean, if you get him now, I mean, you could, I guess, run him out to Instruction League if your Instruction League program's still going on.
Yeah, I think you're all done.
He's not going to do a whole lot between now and spring training anyway.
And he's not a guy you could run in the fall league. I mean, he's just not a guy.
No,
he's just not that power.
You wouldn't want to do that. So,
exactly.
You know, it's kind of, you know, it's like with James Paxton and the Mariners. I mean, you'd, you know, if you want him, you'd like to sign him. But in practical purposes, you don't really need to sign him before spring training. Now, that said, I think you're better off if you're the player, I'd rather sign now, because I still wonder, John, with Bobby Brownlee, who was, you know, supposed to be the best pitcher in his draft and fell into the 20s in the first round to the Cubs a few years back.
Yeah, 2002.
But he didn't sign until February, and I just remember, you know, he was amped up and had to be like basically in peak form in January to show the Cubs again what he had. And then that June, he kind of wore out. He was never really the same pitcher, and I just. No. You get these pitchers, you know, there's any number of pitchers. Matt Harrington's another one. You know, go through these long layoffs, and then they start pitching again or getting peak form at weird times of the year, and it just seems to affect a lot of them negatively. So if I were on the player side, I guess, not that I just want to roll over and, you know, sign for the sake of signing, but I think you're better off signing now rather than having, you know, if you don't sign till before spring training, then you're going to have to, you know, amp up and show these teams what you have again in January and February. And I think it's hard to, you know, constantly ramp your arm up when you're not used to doing that.
I completely agree with you. If I were advising Barrett Lau, my advice would be sign. Take the best offer right now and sign. And, you know, for me, again, I mentioned Eric Goodell. I'd take Eric Goodell over Barrett Lau personally. Bigger arm, better breaking ball. You know, so for me, $750,000 would be crazy. So I mean,
when you were talking to teams, John, I mean, I could not find a team that had either made an offer or talked to another team that had made an offer. I just don't think, and I don't think it's that people don't want Lau. I just don't think anybody's even really made much of a concrete offer to him.
I agree. That's what I found in my impression. Again, it's not just an impression. My impression was you know, the asking price was higher than what people were seeing in the workouts. It's not that he was bad in the workouts, but just that when you're looking for that kind of money and you have that medical track record, you better be really good in the workouts, not just fine. So,
right.
Yeah, I just don't see it. But I really do think the main reason I want to end on that is I do think there's a misperception that there's this, you know, really special draft-changing talent that's out there as a free agent. And if your team doesn't get involved, then it's a really missed opportunity by your team. I just don't see Barrett Laux as that kind of player. I wish him nothing but the best. I don't know him at all, but I was on him out of high school. I remember David Chad and Drive Report Card, unsigned Tigers draft pick, and they really liked him. He was the one who got away.
$800,000 because he really came on at the end of the summer. And,
correct.
No, I agree with you. I mean, he's a nice guy to have. I mean, I liken him. But again, the medical hurts him a little bit. You know, he should have gone probably about where Seth Blair went to the Cardinals in the middle of the sandwich round. And, he'd be nice to add to your inventory, but it's not the equivalent of say, signing, like, a true number six overall pick.
Right. If just the guy after him, if something had happened with Matt Harvey and he got declared a free agent, he would have been snapped up by now,
Assuming he was healthy. Yeah.
Assuming he was healthy. Assuming it was some kind of snafu. He would have been snapped up. So,
interesting thing, I think, with Laux, I mean, they did kind of say, this is a, not any, change in policy. It's a one-time deal, and we'll review other situations in the future. But, I just wonder, we've seen the draft attempted to be manipulated by people before. If somebody's going to try to come up with another scenario where a guy becomes a free agent. And, the thing it made me always think about when I think about Barrett Laux is, Scott Biddle went through exactly the same thing two years ago with the Yankees as a second-round pick. And so it wasn't a high-profile case, but Scott Biddle wanted to sign. I mean, he just went out, at Mississippi, destroyed the entire SEC throwing cutters. The Yankees took him in the second round, and when they did a physical exam, they were worried about the state of his shoulder. Again, it wasn't that he couldn't pitch. It was wear and tear, and they were worried about what it was going to be. And I remember Biddle was so wanted to sign, and when the news leaked out what had happened, he even, at one point, emailed me medical reports from other doctors saying that they thought he was fine.
He went on the offensive, no doubt, but he really wanted
to sign, and the Yankees wouldn't sign him, and he got stuck, and he went back to school, and then, the Cardinals signed him, and he got hurt, and he didn't even pitch this year. So, it is what it is, but it's when you're talking about it, it's basically an interpretation. It's not like either Laux or Biddle had a torn rotator cuff or a blown out, elbow ligament. It was doctors, looking at it and interpreting, based on what I see here, I don't think he's going to hold up, or I do think he's going to hold up. And I just think in a situation like that, depending on which doctor you talk to, you can find guys who are going to say his arm's going to fall off tomorrow, and you're going to find guys who are going to say, I think he's going to be fine for 10 years.
Right. Hey, let's wrap up real fast. I do have one more email from Jerry McDonald, who emails. We'll wrap up real quick with a Blue Jays question. Jerry says he enjoys the podcast, even if half the discussion is on indie ball. Well, that was last week's podcast.
I guess JJ was involved with that one.
That's correct. Leftover topic from last week, the Blue Jays do have a team in the Midwest, Florida State, Eastern League, and Pacific Coast Leagues. Last week, JJ and I couldn't think of anyone who met that test, which is just that you're basically in the kind of extreme leagues offensively is what kind of where that discussion, I believe, started. But he wanted to say that Aaron Sanchez, their supplemental pick, appears to have more advanced than other high school pitchers. He got an Auburn promotion, a short season Auburn promotion, and does have good raw stuff. Among the Jays high school picks, is he the fastest mover? And then he says that even though Dett McGuire was their first pick, he's heard more a lot of excitement about Asher Wojciechowski, who was very good at Auburn. That could he move quickly, maybe even quicker than McGuire? I think, Jim, both of us are Asher Woj fans and thought that he fell. Him falling to the Jays with one of their supplemental picks was one of the reasons why they had a great draft. And I thought he could have gone. It would have shocked me if he'd gone 7 to the Mets or 6 of the Diamondbacks. Frankly, I would have taken Asher Woj over Barrett Laux if you're looking for a below slot pick there. The one question I had about Asher Wojciechowski is he does throw a lot of sliders, and he was ridden pretty heavily at Citadel, especially in the Southern Conference tournament. He threw a lot of pitches in that tournament, two starts. The second start was on either 2 or 3 days rest, and he threw his full allotment, 100-plus pitches in both starts. But I still think Dett McGuire is probably going to move quicker because that's Dett McGuire's shtick, is that he's a four-pitch, polished strike thrower with a good slider. Whereas Asher Wojciechowski's got a good fastball, very good slider. The third pitch may take him some time. And I love Aaron Sanchez. Two words, long toss. he's a long toss guy, big-time long toss guy. And the Blue Jays are a flexible organization that likes their guys to – if you like doing that, they're going to let you do that. I bet you Aaron Sanchez winds up with a plus fastball and a plus changeup from him doing that. And he's got a good, raw, fresh California arm because he's not a showcase monster guy. He's a guy from Barstow, not – not from the LA area. What's your take on that Blue Jays draft and those pitchers in particular? Who moves fastest?
I do think Sanchez will move faster than any of their high school guys, John. I thought he was a guy who was going to go in the first round, to be quite honest. I thought he would have gone the last, say, third of the first round. And I think to get both him and Wojciechowski in the sandwich round was nice. I mean, the first team that was, I think, had a really good chance to maybe take Wojciechowski was the White Sox at number 13. And
yeah.
Every year it seems like there's a college pitcher or two. Brandon Workman was another one this year. Who are talked about as even mid first round picks, somewhere in that like 15 to 20 range. And then some dominoes fall where guys drop because of signability, and it pushes, you know, last year it was Eric Arnett got pushed down a bunch of picks, Kyle Heckethorn got pushed down, and this year it was Asher Wojciechowski was kind of the guy who was the chain reaction guy who tumbled. And yeah, the one way I could see him maybe moving faster than McGuire would be if they moved him to the bullpen very quickly. They're not going to do that.
Right.
And I do think you're right. I do agree with you, John. I do think Deck will probably beat him to the big leagues, because even if they move Wojciechowski to the bullpen, I don't think that would be until 2012, really at the earliest.
Right.
And, you know, Deck's pretty polished. They actually like his slider better than Wojciechowski's.
Right.
And I think there's a chance that McGuire could be, you know, in their rotation very early in 2012. So I think he's going to get there before Asher Wojciechowski. But I do like both those guys. I thought they were, you know, very good value picks, you know, guys who could have gone about 20 picks higher and just happened not to.
Those are some of the nicest things you've ever said about a Georgia Tech player. So, I mean, as a Bulldog, I'm impressed by your impartiality.
I'm very impartial. So
I'm also going to throw in there that the reason I like the Blue Jays draft, this was not a good draft for high school left-handed pitchers. It wasn't a lot of depth at that particular position, and the Blue Jays as an organization used to overdraft left-handers in my mind. I'm thinking of you, David Percy, and Zach Jackson. But Griffin Murphy and Justin Nicolino were on the short list for best high school left-hander in this draft class, and they got them both at 61 and 80. So I like that. I also like the two position players they drafted there, Kellen Sweeney and Chris Hawkins. I'm a big Chris Hawkins guy. They got at 93. So I like their draft, and it wasn't just because they had extra picks. But for some of the reasons we talked about, some guys who fell a little bit lower than maybe we thought they would go. So thanks to Jerry for the question. We had good questions this week on the podcast. We don't always have as many questions, but this is also a longish podcast, Jim, so I apologize that we went a little long, close to an hour, so we better wrap up. Anything else you wanted to add, though, on the draft report cards?
No, I mean, I think they're fun to do every year. I guess as I get older, I continue to shake my head at how I would stubbornly try to do all 30 every year. I must have been a lot younger, and my kids weren't as busy. I don't know how I ever used to do 30 draft report cards, but it's probably one of our more labor-intensive projects, John, I think, in terms of the amount of work that goes into them versus the amount of space. You know, we crammed six of them onto a page of the magazine. And, for the amount of space they get, you know, it's probably like about 8 or 9 inches of space on the page. You know, it probably has the highest ratio of hours spent to inches of copy of just about anything we do at baseball.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's a great way to put it. It is fun to do, though. I'm happy to be part of doing those now, and very happy that we don't have you doing all 30, because it would wear you out before the handbook. That would be impossible to comprehend right now.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's what would happen. Then I'd be dead. You know, I think this year, I mean, was the first time I can remember. I think we were working on the overview the Thursday morning we were going to print, just finalizing that. But I think this is the first time that you and I both went to bed the day before the issue went to press, and all 30 draft report cards have been turned in.
Yeah, you're right. That was it was a record for getting them done as early as possible. So speaking of the prospect handbook, which is we're working on right now, Jim and I are both wrapping up Red Sox and Yankees top 10 calls this week, and obviously the top 30s. That's available in the Prospect Handbook, and we want to remind you that the ultimate 2011 Baseball America reference books are ready for pre-order. You can reserve your books now, and we'll ship them first as soon as they come hot off the press. Go to baseballamerica.com/store and choose among the new 2011 publications, including the Prospect Handbook, the Almanac, the Directory, the Super Register, and the 2011 Great Parks Calendar. Get the advantage in your fantasy league. Of course, we're not talking about the calendar there, we're talking about the handbook. But get the advantage in your
dates you're drafting on your calendar. That can help you in your fantasy.
That could help you. Get your advantage in your fantasy league and be the first to get your books. Visit baseballamerica.com/store for more information. And again, he's Jim Callis. I'm John Manuel. We'll see you next week on the next Baseball America podcast sponsored by MLB Network. Until then, so long, everybody.